All right. Well, here we are again. Good morning, everybody. For the record, my name is Phil Albrechts. I'm the hearing examiner for Kitsap County here on the second remand of the Silverview Administrative Conditional Use Permit and CEPA appeal files 23-00913 and 23-02974. Looks like I think we have all the necessary attorneys, right? We got Mr. Schutz and Mr. Lin on behalf of the applicant, Ms. Clungeon on behalf of the appellants, and my screen doesn't tell me who's here. Is it just Ms. Oda on behalf of the county, or are there any other county attorneys?
I believe that Neil Wachter is going to be logging on. I'll check in with him.
Oh, okay. Should we wait? We can wait a couple minutes.
I see he joined through the public link, so let me pull him over as a panelist right now.
Okay, perfect. All right.
Should just be a few seconds and you'll see him on your screen. There we go.
All right, there he is. Okay, welcome, Mr. Wachter. All right, so I think in just first thing to go over is in some emails that we went over the last few days. I guess the applicants have agreed to go first. Is my understanding everyone's okay with that? The county had advocated that after the applicant requested to go first on the feasibility issue. So I think we're set on that. The next thing, unless are there any preliminary matters before we jump into exhibits, or like in this most hearings, I think it's best to get the exhibit lists in all at once. We'll say that one point to look out for is the foundational exhibit list only contains the exhibits starting from the notice of decision of the last remand forward. So I'm assuming that the parties are okay with that. We don't need to get in any other prior exhibits. Is that right?
On behalf of the applicant, we're not planning on pulling up or citing any of the prior exhibits to understand.
Okay. All right. Anyone else have any problem with just admitting the foundational exhibit list as is?
No, but we may rely on some of the exhibits from the previous hearing. So,
okay. Well, I guess yeah. Why don't you bring them up if and when you need it, and then we can discuss the admissibility at that point. So, yeah, that'll make sense. So, I'll go ahead and admit the foundational exhibit list. How about the applicant's exhibit list? Any objections over the exhibits listed in the applicant exhibit list?
Objection.
No objection.
Okay, that's admitted. Appellant's exhibit list?
No objection.
Okay, those are admitted. And finally, the county exhibit list, which I think was just limited to the staff report. Any objections over that? All right, yeah, I'm not anticipating that. So those are admitted as well. Okay.
For the staff report, wasn't that issued only just a couple of days ago beyond the exhibit disclosure?
Oh, let me check.
Deadline.
Okay. Does the county want to respond to that? I'm just pulling it up, right?
Certainly, and my colleague may chime in here, but I will say this. It was prepared essentially in the wake of the other submittals. The county's kind of in the unfortunate position of having to absorb everything that's been provided by the other parties, and we had to process and kind of evaluate materials, including the Cook report. So it's in a sense, it's a rebuttal, but it is nonetheless our staff report for this.
Okay. And when was it submitted? Was it the 28th? Is that the date?
Excuse me. I believe that's right. Yes.
Okay. All right. So Ms. Clungeon, are you objecting to it or just inquiring?
Okay, if it was submitted on the 28th, it's just that we, the appellants would have appreciated the county staff report prior or in one of the earlier submittals. It's sort of, we didn't have the opportunity to respond to the staff report in any of the rebuttal, so.
Okay. Yeah, well, I can see the county has felt the need to respond to everybody else. If there's a need to, you know, leave the record open a few days for additional response, then we'll handle it that way then.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay, so otherwise, I'll admit it. And then if the appellants need a little more time to respond to something in the staff report, we can figure out how to do that. All right. I think that deals with the.
Sorry,
Sorry.
I have one clarification on exhibits. I noticed over the weekend that one of our exhibits was mislabeled. B6 says site plan with alternative wetland. It was brought to my attention that that is the site plan without the alternative wetland. The site plan with the alternative wetland is in the record at F18, page 7. I just wanted to get that clarification on the record before we
So
start.
what was that exhibit number again?
B6
Oh, B6, okay.
is labeled site plan with alternative wetland. It does not have the alternative wetland. It's the site plan without the alternative
Oh.
wetland. Site plan is at F18, page 7, and we'll discuss that during testimony. But I just wanted to make sure that
Okay.
Amber
May
was aware.
clarify that. Yeah. Okay. That's admitted with that understanding then. All
Thank you.
right. Okay, Mr. Schultz, I guess you guys go first. So you can
Excuse
do an
me.
opening. Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. And again, Neil Wachter on behalf of the county. And my apologies for not logging in the correct pathway here. I had just one matter of housekeeping I was hoping to broach before we got much further. And apologies, I'm new to this matter. I recently rejoined the county, and I've been sort of drinking from the fire hose the past month. And this is my first hearing in the out of the gate. So I will try to keep my I'll say remedial questions to a minimum. But I noticed in looking over everything that there really is not. Because there's two issues that have been remanded, Mr. Examiner, it occurs to me that there's not a it does not appear to be evidence submitted by the appellants regarding the underground parking issue. And I suspect that the appellants do not dispute the existence of aquifers, or at least an aquifer on the property that is discussed in the applicant's materials. And it occurs to me that Mr. Examiner, we don't have a summary judgment rule, but if this was a court sort of setting, we'd be in the situation where this issue is one where there's evidence solely on one side and not the other. This is not going to come as a shock to anyone. The county is going to be looking at these kind of cases case by case, but it appears that the applicant has done what was asked of it in terms of demonstrating evidence in support of a finding of infeasibility. And I just would ask aloud if that is an issue that could be disposed of at the outset, because the county does not, I mean, the county is willing, at this point, the county is accepting that the applicant has met that burden. And it seems that this may not be an issue that needs to be litigated in any depth in the course of the hearing.
Okay. Yeah, it is a kind of an odd issue in that the appellants probably would prefer not to have taller buildings that include this parking. So they yeah, I suspect they're likely not opposed to a summary judgment ruling on that. What do you think, Ms. Clungeon?
I mean, we would be opposed to summary judgment on the
Oh,
parking
okay.
issue. I
I
would
mean,
point
yeah.
out that appellants did provide an exhibit related to the underbuilding parking. That's Mr. Adams' exhibit. And additionally,
Okay. Well, that no, that's fine.
It's
I
the
mean,
substance
obviously.
of this hearing. We haven't had the opportunity to basically assess, and we, had the feasibility analysis been included in the original application, appellants would have likely appealed that issue as being insufficient or not having adequate information in order to actually address that feasibility. We would want the opportunity to contest that it is
Yeah,
feasible
okay.
or that there is not adequate information in order to assess whether it is feasible.
Yeah, no, understood. I mean, Summary judgment motions are always allowed in these proceedings, and it would have been incorporated into the pre-hearing order if anybody had requested it, and nobody has. So obviously, if the appellants contest an abbreviated summary judgment process like this morning, I can certainly accede to that objection. And I think, yes, since the appellants do want an opportunity to contest it, I think we'll have to move forward with the presentation of evidence on that.
So, and look, it probably wasn't my best choice of words, but point being is I was making a comment on what I perceived to be the state of the evidence, and I thought I'd probably just better bring it up at this point and see what we wanted to do with it.
Nothing
further on that. I'm sorry.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, I mean, any efforts to streamline this remand are greatly appreciated. Love any ideas that people present. So, but yeah, like I said, normally, you know, if it were a summary judgment issue or something, you know, similar to that, it would have been raised as a pre-hearing motion where the parties had a chance to argue it. And certainly if the parties would have agreed to dispose of it that way right now, I would be okay with that. But the appellants don't. That's just fine. So, all right, Mr. Schutz, I'll go back to you then.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. I have a brief opening statement I'd like to provide, just a couple of minutes to kind of outline where we're going in this hearing. And then I'd like to call my first witness, which will be Michael Bielski. I always have a hard time with that name, but I've been working on it.
Okay.
So first, thank you, Mr. Examiner, for allowing us to have this opportunity to address the last two issues in this case. We're confident that we've submitted sufficient record on remand to establish that underbuilding parking for this project on this site is infeasible, and that the applicant has done what it needed to do on remand with regard to ensuring that the wetland analysis has been completed and exhausted. as you've likely read from our materials, there's actually three independent reasons why the parking is infeasible on this property and for this project. You know, any one of them alone is sufficient, and together they're compelling. So the first independent reason is that excavation should be no deeper than necessary. This was agreed upon at the last hearing. In fact, applicants' witnesses testified repeatedly that even the current design was too much for the artesian aquifer. Wider, bigger foundations, bigger, heavier, wider concrete structured parking foundations will have an impact on the artesian aquifer. More excavation, more digging is just a bad idea. And a second independent reason, you know, kind of arises from the building codes, the international building codes, and that's like the dimensions of structured parking. So structured parking, you know, has drive aisles, it has ramps, it has parking on either side, it has structural elements like pillars to hold the weight, it has additional footings. And this requires it to be larger, and it requires, you know, to avoid, you know, to even attempt to avoid more excavation, it requires it to be taller as well. Another part of that is this travel distance, which we'll touch on in the hearing. And that's the code and building code requirements from, you know, getting from the top to getting to the bottom and getting out. And so there's a couple obstacles with that. The one is, you know, if you have a podium and say an elevator just to the podium, you're gonna have four stories above to make the building cost effective. You're gonna have to walk up four stories. And that's, you're not gonna be able to ask renters to do that, to move their stuff up, move sofas, et cetera, up four stories. It's not rentable, it's not marketable. And so, you know, even if you get around the 125 feet to the exit, as Mr. Adams says, put a balcony on there so that you can run down to the other staircase. It doesn't matter, because going up four flights is just not, it's not feasible. So the likely solution then would be elevators all the way up. And there's a couple problems with that. One is that, you know, you don't have these garden style apartments that are, you know, that with elevators, because elevators go up and there's a central corridor and elevator banks. The rooms are then on either side instead of just going straight through. Staircases on either side, or on either side of the building, adding bulk. It results in bigger, wider buildings. It results in a different project, frankly. And that gets to the third independent analysis, and that's the cost of structured parking. To put structured parking, just the structured parking alone on the site, would take this project out of the range of rents that that this project is designed for. So the comprehensive plan, has a contemplation for this area, and it's apartments that are affordable to people who work and live in the central district of Silverdale zone, so that they can walk to their work, walk to shopping, et cetera. And the rent you can get, based on market analysis, which has been done and will be discussed, people won't be able to pay it if you add in the cost of structured parking. And that doesn't account for all the other costs. Then the elevators have their own costs. The bigger, bulkier buildings and all the stuff inside and the staircase at the end, all those have additional costs that adds on, and ultimately makes it, based on cost, infeasible to have this sort of project, which is exactly what the comprehensive plan, calls for. And a lot of these issues, they interact and they overlap. So, for example, Mr. Adams has proposed that you have a structured parking and then a podium, and the elevator goes to the podium, and then you climb up from there. And we talked about why it's problematic for that many stairs. But it's also problematic because you have to account for different structural aspects. If you build buildings straight up, which our architect and structural engineer will talk about, you put the weight on the outside of the foundation. If the building's smaller on top, then you have to create new structure in the parking garage, adding costs, adding complications, making it a much more difficult project. So you kind of solve one potentially, which you don't really, but then you're adding another. So it's complicated in that way as well. And actually, Mr. Adams suggested alternatives raise a fourth issue that I think is worth noting. And that's whether the modifications, or the modified proposals that he's put on the table, whether those in and of themselves would violate the Silverdale design standards. The presumed reason for having underbuilding parking is to keep the cars out of sight, right? To hide the cars and make them less visible. But his proposals add structured parking, and in one proposal, two layers of structured parking up above the grade. So now you're having neighbors looking at open structured parking. They have to be open for ventilation reasons. You have lights on, you have cars driving up above the grade now with their headlights and so forth. And he admits they have to be, at least the structures themselves have to be much bigger. So you have these large concrete structures with cars driving up in and lights, et cetera. And so it contravenes, numerous other guidelines. And obviously, it would be a worse case for the hiding the parking, much worse than what's proposed now, which is more screening than is required by code. And then during the last hearing, you probably remember that there was testimony that nobody would see the cars from the ground at the ground level based on the screening. The where feasible language in the design standards, should take that into account, whether it makes it worse for the neighbors. So, bigger buildings, above ground structured parking, it also violates the up versus out, mandate, and other ones in the design standards as well. I think it's fair to say that the applicant and the county can be, faulted for not providing a better description of why this is infeasible during the prior hearing, the one before even. And maybe that's because it was pretty evident to all concerned at the time as they were going through the design review process. But be that as it may, now we've established beyond any, reasonable argument for multiple reasons that parking for this site with the artesian aquifer, the grades, and the design standards, et cetera, is infeasible. So that's, we'll talk about that in a little more depth with the experts, but that's the infeasibility kind of road we're going down. The wetlands, you know, as you recall, Mr. Examiner, you remanded for more wetland analysis, essentially to dig alongside Dr. Cook's data plots to ensure that there wasn't wetland where she'd found wetland indicators. So the applicant's consultants, excuse me, Phil Scholes and Rachel Hyland, they went out, they did that work. They dug more pits than the conditions required. They dug next to each of Dr. Cook's data plots. Mr. Scholes' findings are contained in his report, and he'll present his findings to you. But bottom line is they didn't find any wetland indicators at that location, at any of those locations. So the county's consultant went out, and though mostly was in agreement, there was one spot where they were not in agreement, and that's this DP6 location, which you'll hear in the testimony. You know, the result of that was six more data plots dug around DP6, none of which showed wetland indicators. And all of that is in the record with photographs of those six additional data plots dug everywhere around DP6. But setting that aside, I mean, the fact that there's a ton of evidence to show that there's no wetland there. We presented in the report an alternative wetland, which is sort of a worst case, to include that wetland in. And it expands the wetland from 355 to, I think it's 570 feet or so. It's large enough to encompass that one disputed spot. This is a place that's been dug to death. And this is a way as an alternative. So we don't think there's wetland at that spot to say the applicant is willing to do that with a revised site plan, which we have in the record and doesn't move, you know, any structural elements, just moves a parking space. So that's something the applicant's willing to do, you know, in order to get past, you know, finally this wetland issue. Again, thank you for allowing us this opportunity to establish these last two facts, and we look forward to presenting this evidence and answering, you know, any questions that you may have.
Okay, yeah, just a kind of a real fundamental basic one. It's trying to roadmap what's going to be happening here in my mind. What changes, if any, have been done to the last project? I think it's a potential increase in the size of the wetland. And then you also mentioned, I think in your pre-hearing brief, kind of expanding the entryways to the buildings. Is that pretty much it or not?
It is, and I don't want to testify that our witnesses will come on and do that.
Okay.
But essentially, they looked at a couple of different ways of trying to get underbuilding parking in, what those changes would be, determined that they were infeasible, and determined that the current design is the most feasible and should move forward.
Okay, sounds good. All right, let's bring up the first witness.
Okay, so my first witness is Michael Piowski.
Okay, Miss Jones, you bringing them up? And like last time, we'll take a break about every hour and a half, take an hour lunch break around noon. Same old format. All right, Mr. Yowski, let me swear you in. Just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, great. All right, go ahead, Mr. Schutz.
You. Mr. Bielski, can you please give your name and address to the examiner for the record?
Michael F. Piasky, office address is 2105 South C, Tacoma, Washington, 98402. Company name is Terraphase Engineering now, for the record. Robinson Noble was acquired a couple of years back.
Thank you. And you testified during the last hearing, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I believe the examiner, you know, heard your education and experience, and so I don't want to belabor it, but just for the record, could you know, give a brief background as to that experience and education?
Sure. I've got a bachelor's and master's degree in geology from the University of Missouri. Since then, I've been employed as a geologist and hydrogeologist for about the past 31, 32 years, the last 29 of which have been here in Tacoma, first with Robinson Noble, now with Terraphase. The only transition was the name on the door. I'm still working in essentially the same building, the same office with the same people. We've just got a new owner.
Thank you. So at the last hearing, you talked about the artesian aquifer. Do you
I did.
recall And I believe you were asked about your opinions on digging deeper than the current design. Do you recall what that opinion was?
I don't recommend digging any deeper.
Okay. You provided a report on remand.
Yes, there's a letter on remand, and that basically restated our initial report. Those findings have been consistently stated and phrased.
Okay. And I believe that's at Exhibit 16, B, sorry, no, Foundational Exhibit 16 for the record. So let's just talk about your analysis on remand. What did you look at as part of that analysis?
We were asked on remand to evaluate the potential effects of digging deeper at the locations to accommodate a proposed deeper foundation excavation, potentially due to elevator shafts or subgrade parking or some combination of both. I was given an additional depth to evaluate. So we revised our drawings and looked at calculations based on that additional depth provided by the engineers and architects on our project team, and advised against digging any deeper based on an unacceptable risk due to the deeper excavation.
And could you expand on that a little bit, why you reached that conclusion?
The underlying aquifer is under some amount of pressure. The exact amount, we don't know. We haven't exactly measured it, but there are wells that show water levels above surface. And we would expect that that continues across this property. An artesian aquifer is a common thing in lower elevations in the Puget Sound region. We have hills around the sound, and the aquifers are draped down those hills and then covered by lower permeability, in this case, glacial till deposits that act as a cap. Water recharges the aquifer higher up the hill, and water seeks its own level. So if you are putting water into an aquifer higher up a hill, there are places down near the bottom of the hill, such as basically the bottom of nearly every valley in Puget Sound, where the water at some depth is at a level higher than land surface. That's imparting a pressure based on just that head difference. Water is pushing against the top of that confining layer. So the till cap is being pushed against by this artesian pressure. If we dig away that till cap, that pressure may get to a point where it's sufficient to breach the remaining cap, which would result in uncontrolled discharge from the artesian aquifer. That's a very bad thing because we can't exactly just close the valve, put the water back in.
So during the last hearing, I believe you testified that as the current design, as proposed, does not create a significant risk of aquifer breach. Is that correct?
By our calculations, more than 50% of the till surface is unaltered or unexcavated, untouched. And due to the relatively simple foundations and footings proposed, there's not going to be an extensive amount of time for that excavation to sit open. So, yes, it was considered to be an acceptable level of risk.
And so the depths that you were asked to look at, do you remember what those were?
I believe I was initially, for the remand, I believe I was initially given numbers of 12 feet and 6 feet.
And which number did you use? Sorry, who did you get it from?
That was from the team. I believe it was the architecture group that provided the, no, it was the structural engineer that provided those numbers.
Okay, and which one of those, the 6 or the 12, did you use in your
We
analysis?
used the 6 foot number because that's far more conservative.
Okay. You talked briefly about the time it's left exposed. Why does that matter?
Till is not a cohesive soil. It's compact, it's very hard, but it's not cohesive. And pressure over time is what causes failure. So if you provide a little bit of pressure over a long time, you can have a similar effect to a larger pressure over a short time.
So would a more complex structure that takes longer to build be more problematic when you're talking about an artisanal?
Intuitively, yes. I mean, we're kind of getting outside my area of expertise as a hydrogeologist, but the more forms you have to set, the more groundwork you need to do, the more complicated those forms are, the more reinforcing steel needs to be placed. That's just more time for the construction process.
Okay, I appreciate that. How about wider foundations? We talked about deeper. Does wider pose any sort of issue as well?
Well, a wider foundation is going to go uphill, cutting deeper into the grade, which would excavate further than our initial evaluated amount.
Does it have any impact on as far as the
Oh, yeah, a wider excavation would also be more vulnerable in that a wider diaphragm of the same thickness is going to be more flexible. And since we're dealing with like I said, a compact but not necessarily cohesive soil, that would be more prone to failure, all else remaining equal.
Okay. Mr. Adams and his report that he submitted, first of all, have you reviewed that report?
I have.
Okay. I believe that he implies that a smaller area for the elevator being a bit deeper is not as big a deal as the if the whole thing is deeper. Is digging in one location a little bit deeper, is that not a problem?
A small uncontrolled hole in an artesian aquifer is just as bad as a large uncontrolled hole into an artesian aquifer. There's a recent example of this up in Vancouver, British Columbia, where a driller was drilling holes for a ground source heat pump system and a subdivision for a new home being constructed, and breached an artesian aquifer and did exactly the wrong things. He lost control of the hole, left the site, and that hole remained uncontrolled and flowing, which jeopardized a number of other structures in the area. Ultimately, the property owner and the driller fled the country to avoid responsibility for the mess. It was about $10.5 million Canadian to get that little 8-inch diameter hole plugged. It was about 37 feet deep.
Mr. Adams, I think, describes the analysis and the feasibility analysis that was provided to the county of which your report was a part of as quote unquote alarmist. Would you agree with that?
No.
Know you looked at 6 feet as the depth as what was provided to you by the structural engineer. But would you recommend digging any deeper on this site at all?
No. We've consistently stated that the original plan is the preferred option and a safe plan. Any deeper involves undue risk.
Thank you. I think that's all the questions I have, Mr. Examiner.
Okay, Ms. Clemson, any cross? And you'll have to unmute yourself. There we go.
Maybe just a little bit. All right. Good morning. Is it Mr. Piowski? Is that
Pronunciation of my name is actually Piaski, and hooked
Piowski?
on phonics will absolutely not help you.
Okay.
Sorry
All
about
right.
that.
Okay. All right. All right, Mr. Piowski. Yeah. I'm Mr. P.
Might works.
So you mentioned that you were asked, your assessment was regarding digging deeper, right? Were you at all asked about keeping it the same depth but adding weight?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Going to be 30 city later this week.
All right, so all of your analysis is based on the assumption that we would be going deeper instead of up, right?
No, ma'am. My initial analysis was based on the plans as presented. The secondary analysis under remand was a discussion of an increased depth, which I advised against.
Okay, all right. in your opinion, if the foundation was to stay at the same depth, and say a shallow elevator, a shallow shaft for an elevator, maybe an additional 2 foot in a one small section of the building where it would have, maybe we have more of the confining layer to work with. Wouldn't you agree that that would likely not pose a risk to the aquifer?
As I've stated all along, any additional depth involves additional risk. And the location of that additional depth is absolutely going to affect the level of risk. But it doesn't take a large hole to create a very large, expensive problem, like I demonstrated with the Beechwood situation up in British Columbia. And that's not the only situation where such an artesian aquifer breach has taken place. There have been plenty of other ones. That's just one I'm a little bit more familiar with.
Okay. But that was at a, I believe you said, a depth of 37 feet, right?
That's still fairly shallow for settings, and we're much shallower than that here.
Okay.
So if anything, we're at higher risks here.
Okay.
Which is why I don't advise digging any deeper.
Okay. So say for the larger foundation, not digging any deeper, are there sections of the foundation where it would be better? Basically, are there sections of the foundation where placing the elevator could be more or less problematic for the depth to the aquifer?
I've not seen those plans, so I can't speculate.
Okay. But we do have variability in the depth of the confining till layer, correct?
Certainly.
Okay. And so there could be areas where we have more till than less under the foundations of these buildings.
That was all demonstrated in our 2021 report. We've presented all the data we have.
Okay. Okay, so would you agree that there are some parts of the foundation that there is more confining to layer available?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. You know, I've demonstrated that in my report. That was before the remand. That was presented before the second hearing. You know, we've demonstrated that the till thickness is variable, and that at two locations, we drilled through the till and into an aquifer beneath the till, causing the, you know, concern that has been discussed since that point, leading to my recommendation that don't dig any deeper than absolutely possible on this site and work around the known hazard that has been identified to mitigate potential risks of very expensive problems. Mm-hmm. Now, nothing's changed. We've said the same thing every time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No further questions.
Okay. Mr. Wachter, any questions?
Thank you. So, Mr. Piasky, I had just a couple of follow-up questions. What was the depth of the aquifer at those two test drill locations?
Let me pull the notes so I can give you an exact number. We encountered it in boring number 5 at a depth of, I got to turn the acrobats being helpful. Pardon me, I got to rotate the view here. Let's see. Now I can read up and down, not sidey sidey. 23 feet below grade in boring number 5. And 28 feet below grade in boring number 6.
And did you have an opinion about whether those two borings were representative of aquifer depth conditions on the property?
That's what we observed when we drilled the wells on the borings, excuse me, on the property. So it was that's that we described what we saw.
And apologies if this is old news because it may have been covered in the previous hearing, but how many borings total did you do, if you recall?
We did eight of the deeper soil borings on the property. There was
So
some
six.
shallower work done previously. Six of the eight did not penetrate all the way through the till, but the two that did were the shallower of the borings because, well, we penetrated through the till and didn't want to create a problem.
So for the six of the eight that did not reach water, or the aquifer, how deep did you go before you stopped?
Total depth was 35 and a half, 36 and a half, 36 and a half, 31 and a half, well, 36 and a half and 36 on the others. So between 35 and a half and 36 and a half feet, which was our general scope.
And have you evaluated just how deep one would have to go to establish two levels of underground parking, or is that outside the scope of your
That is,
evaluation?
I'm a hydrogeologist, not a geotechnical engineer, so that's well outside the area of my expertise.
You described an example of a breached artesian aquifer in Vancouver, BC. Obviously, every site has differences. Are you able to compare soil and aquifer conditions with this of this property of the subject property with that BC property that you described? I mean, one could it could be I guess I could be cynical and say, well, this is all apples and oranges because every property is different. Why should that be instructive to us?
Well, actually, Vancouver, BC is quite a similar area, geologically speaking and geomorphologically speaking, in that we have a low-lying urban area next to mountains adjacent to salt water, which is pretty much the entire Puget Sound region. The area was sculpted and formed and shaped by the exact same glaciation and glacial processes that formed the current Puget Sound region. So while there's a international boundary between us and them, the processes involved in putting those sediments where they are and how they are, and the processes involved in the water flowing through those sediments is actually quite similar.
Okay. And so, Mr. Piotrowski, have you seen similar instances of an aquifer breach? I'll say closer to home or closer to
Oh,
here
there
on
are a
here on
few.
here. Sorry, I interrupted you. Here on the west side of Puget Sound.
Duval area, there was a gravel mine that inadvertently excavated through a confining layer and caused a uncontrollable breach into the underlying artesian aquifer that is still flowing and is now a tributary to the Snoqualmie. There's an artesian well that they lost control of in, I believe it's Gold Bar. It's up that way off Highway 2. That one I'm less familiar with, but it's my understanding that that well is now a pond. There are several up in the Okanagan. There are, those aren't necessarily on the west side of the Puget Sound region, but I've got firsthand experience with a number of artesian aquifers just in the Puget Sound Basin. The goal is to know they're there and mitigate when you're working near them. And that mitigation is actually spelled out in the drilling regulations in the state of Washington. We have to have a written sealing plan on file before we drill a well into a known artesian aquifer. We're working on a artesian well for the city of Bremerton right now. And it's one of several that we've worked on in Bremerton. So artesian aquifers are ubiquitous. They're quite common. In the lowland, those aquifers often flow. The somewhat unique nature of this particular site is the shallowness of that aquifer. Oftentimes, the aquifers are a little bit deeper having flowing artesian conditions within 26 feet of land surface is difficult to control because we need to create enough pressure to offset that artesian pressure within 26 feet. And it's difficult to do that. When we're working in a deeper well, we can use weighted drilling fluid or we can use a heavier cement compound to plug things. But with only 26 feet of difference between the top of the aquifer and land surface to work with, potentially even less if we've started excavating at that location, we really do have our hands tied when it comes to the typical methods used to control artesian aquifers. We've worked with setting a pump station over an artesian aquifer for Lake Haven Water and Sewer in Federal Way. That aquifer was also fairly shallow, and unlike the one here in Silverdale, it is even higher head. We had static water levels of over 20 feet above land surface from an aquifer 35 feet deep. So that took a lot of effort to get that pump station safely installed. But with the efforts of the engineers and the project team, it was successfully completed.
So, Mr. Pioski, in the worst case scenario of penetrating an aquifer, if that happens, then what has to be done, or can steps be taken to render a site buildable in the future?
They still haven't built on the site of Beechwood up in British Columbia. They did get the flow plugged. To control the flow at Beechwood, they mobilized a fleet of drilling rigs and drilled wells all the way around the property in the street right of way to avoid drilling on private property, and pumped those wells nonstop for several months to reduce the head on the aquifer. The main difference between the Beechwood case and here is that the people upstream rely on that same artesian aquifer and downstream, in fact, to provide water to their homes. If you turn on all those pumps and dewater that aquifer, you've got to provide all of those people that were drinking that water an alternative. The plug is something that is not easy to do, especially in the case of an excavation where there's no drill casing and nothing in place. If you just, break open the top, you've got a material that actually erodes away as the water flows past it. So the hole grows and it gets bigger. There's a very real possibility that uncontrolled flow may never be fully controlled.
I guess my last question is this, is can compression of an aquifer result in changes to the discharge points of the water?
That's a very, very, very broad question. Compression of an aquifer, meaning compaction as a result of, processes or natural disaster. And
no, I mean specifically as a result of the construction above it. The weight of a structure.
Typically speaking, the weight of a structure is not significant in the overall grand scheme of things, but that's going to vary based on the structure and it's going to vary based on the aquifer setting. So it's a very open-ended question that's difficult to really put an answer on.
Fair enough. I guess I'm sorry, I found one other question I had on my list here, and that's can you articulate a safety factor that you apply in pronouncing your opinion or your concern about deeper excavation on this subject property?
Again, I'm not a geotechnical engineer. The safety factor we arrived at in a quick discussion with geotechnical engineers was if more than half of the till thickness between land surface and the top of the aquifer remained, we were concerned, but not overly so. If less than half remained, we were very concerned. More analysis would need to be done about the specific excavation and the specific plans at the time to really evaluate that. And that evaluation would be better done by engineering folks rather than a hydrogeologist. I'm not an expert when it comes to geotechnical engineering.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your answers to my questions.
All right, Mr. Schutz, any redirect?
No redirect. Thank you,
Mr. Schutz. All right, thanks for your testimony, Mr. Piasky. We really appreciate it. Have a great rest of the day. Well, Mr. Schutz, who's your next witness there?
My next witness will be Mike Miller.
Okay. One sec, I'll pull him over. You should see him on your screen in just a few seconds.
Okay. Oh, there he is. Okay, Mr. Miller, just to make sure you're unmuted and I'll swear you in. And we don't have your video yet either. There he is. Okay. Mr. Miller, just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes.
All right, great. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Schutz.
Good morning, Mr. Miller. Could you provide your name and an address to the examiner?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. What happened? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, sorry about that. My name's Mike Miller. My address is 1446 Madrona Point Drive, Bremerton, Washington.
Thank you. And could you provide your professional qualifications and experience for the examiner, please?
Yeah, sure. I'm an architect. I got a first architectural degree from the University of Washington. And I received a Master of Architecture from the University of Oregon in 1983. I have over 40 years of experience designing multifamily housing and healthcare. Most of that experience in the last 20 years has been in the realm of strategy, feasibility, and programming for major medical institutions, large senior housing communities, and hospitality work.
Okay. Do you have any certifications that are relevant for your architectural qualifications?
Well, I have an NCARB certification, which is the architectural certification that allows you to be licensed in various states from your home state. Prior to my retirement, I believe I was licensed in probably six different states, including the state of Washington. I'm currently still licensed in Washington. I'm a member of a number of different professional organizations like Leading Age and WSHE, which are senior living and healthcare organizations.
Okay. I think you touched on this briefly, but could you provide a little more background on the types of projects you focused on during your career?
Yeah, sure. So as I said, I have about 40, maybe 45 years of architectural practice. The first 18 years of that were at NBBJ, which is a large national, international firm located with their headquarters in Seattle, but they have offices all over the world. In those 18 years, the first part of my experience was in healthcare design and programming and strategy. Eventually, I was asked to take a look at a senior living market. So I was the leader of the NBBJ senior living market. Projects that I worked on at NBBJ included Virginia Mason Medical Center, Swedish Medical Center, Renown Health in Reno, Scripps Clinic in La Jolla, San Diego area. I did a major master plan for most of those facilities. I did also a major master plan and feasibility study for Horizon House, a retirement community in downtown Seattle. Prior to leaving NBBJ, I was named a principal, but as I was being named a principal, I had already made a decision to leave and join a firm in Bremerton called Rice Fergus, which is now Rice Fergus Miller. So at Rice Fergus Miller, my responsibility was really looking at strategy, feasibility, and programming for primarily healthcare and senior living clients throughout the Pacific Northwest. So some of that client base would have been Emerald Communities in Redmond, Timber Ridge in Issaquah, Trillium in Minnesota, Horizon House in downtown Seattle, and the healthcare clients primarily included local healthcare. So Harrison Hospital, which is now St. Michael Medical Center in Bremerton and Silverdale. And then I did a major master plan for Franciscan Health. I did looked at five hospitals for them, looking at their strategy and feasibility to maintain and expand those facilities throughout the Southern Puget Sound.
Okay, thank you. In the course of doing feasibility analysis and design of these projects you're talking about, did you work on structured parking? Was that a component of some projects?
Yes. I think if I look back, I can probably count maybe 12, 13, or 14 projects, primarily in the senior living world, that we placed structured parking underneath wood frame buildings. In one case, it was a concrete building, but primarily underneath wood frame buildings.
So when you approach designing a project or feasibility analysis, what are some of the things that you look at as part of that process?
Well, it's a little bit of a fluid process, but you know, you have a client and they have an idea about what they want to do with a piece of property, for instance. And so the first thing I have to do is look at what their goals and objectives are for that property, you know, program the site in terms of what those goals are, and look at whether achieving those goals and objectives is feasible on a site. So when you look at the feasibility part of that, you're going to be looking at the site itself and its physical characteristics. You know, is it flat? Is it sloping? What's its aspect, for instance, to sun and prevailing winds? Because that helps with the siting of buildings. You want to be looking at zoning code, obviously, and any other jurisdictional requirements. We also would look at potential cost for the development of that project so that it pencils out with what the goals and objectives are for that client. And we take all of that and wrap it into what I would call a site-specific facility feasibility and strategic master plan for the site that shows how the site would be developed over time if a project had to be phased, for instance.
And if a project doesn't pencil out as you describe, I mean, in your mind, is it feasible?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
If a project doesn't pencil out, using your words, is it feasible in your mind?
Well, no. If the site or other constraints cause the project to become too expensive, for example, or there might be environmental characteristics on the site, then it becomes infeasible to develop the site.
Okay. And so what were you asked to do with regard to this project, Henri Man?
So I was asked to assist the design team. I'm not the designer of the project, but I was asked to assist the design team with an analysis of feasibility.
Okay.
For underground parking.
So you didn't design the current buildings. Do you have an opinion about whether the current plan is a good design for this site?
Yeah, I think it's a great design solution. It's garden style apartments that sit lightly on the site. And I think what's what's good about the solution is that you can come in to the apartments at grade level on two of the levels. So you come into the lower level, the basement level, you can park your car on site, walk straight into your apartment. You don't have to transition any stairways. If you go to the upper hillside, you can do the same thing. You can park your car and walk directly into your apartment. And then kind of the magic of the project is that it's only two levels of stairways to get from the upper level up into level 3 and 4.
And so you said it sits lightly. Why would that be important?
Well, you always want to try and reduce the cost of foundations. And a wood frame building is, frankly, mostly air. There's obviously structure that you have to deal with, seismic structure and vertical gravity loads. But it's a fairly lightweight structure to place on the site. And, you know, the other part of what I like about the design solution on this site is the way the buildings follow grade. They sit on the grade well, open themselves up to views and sunlight and prevailing winds.
So just going back real quick, is a building that sits lightly, you know, wood frame structure like this, does it have less, is less foundation work required for such a building?
Yes.
When in the course of your work on feasibility and other things and designs, so you often look at comprehensive plans. Is that part of your review, understanding what's allowed at the site and what's contemplated?
Well, yeah, you sort of, you know, the zoning code and Silverdale design standards are primary piece that you're looking at, but you also want to be aware of what's going on from the county's point of view in terms of their comprehensive plan and the urban growth areas, which I believe the site is in. You know, also looking at what type of housing the comprehensive plan is proposing as the best utilization for this area, and also thinking about missing middle housing. I should have said in my introduction that in addition to my education, I'm also on the City of Bremerton Planning Commission. So Bremerton just went through their 2024 20-year comprehensive plan, which was approved recently. And I know that had to kind of nest in with the criteria that's in the county comprehensive plan.
So have you looked at the comprehensive plan as it relates to the Silverdale central district here, the zone that this property is in?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you have an opinion on whether the current plan meets the comp plan goals?
Yeah, I think it meets the goals. Yes.
Okay. So for what? For the housing type that's
looking yeah. So one of the goals for Silverdale, and that's in the comprehensive plan, and frankly, one of the goals that's in the Puget Sound Regional Council plan for Silverdale is that they provide housing that's, you know, middle moderate income, however you want to define it, that's suitable for people to live in and work near where they live. The ability to shop or walk to your job, or to take transit to your job. So a site near transit is also part of what's looked at from that point of view. So in that respect, I think this project fits that kind of perfectly.
Okay. So there was a feasibility report submitted by the applicant. I believe it's at Exhibit 16. Did you contribute to that report?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And was that, you know, was there collaboration or how, what was that process like?
So it was a collaboration with Inova, the engineering architecture firm that designed the building. Also looked at the hydrology reports and other reports that were submitted by other professionals. And then I reviewed the Silverdale design standards and the zoning code for Kitsap County. And as you said, or as I said, the comp plan and the other inputs that are brought to this site.
Thank you. I want to talk about feasibility of structured parking on the property. What goes into structured parking? And I think I'll try to share here an exhibit that we submitted. So bear with me, everyone, please. Okay, is everyone looking at the lower ground level garage?
Nope, not open yet. Just your file directory at this point.
Second.
Nope, just still the directory.
Always opens on the wrong page.
There it is. Got it. Okay.
So this is exhibit B1 for the record. So I wanted to have this up, but I wanted to, you know, let you explain. My question, I think, was what goes into structured parking? And that's sort of a general question, then we can apply it to the property.
Right. So you're going to have obviously a parking garage. It's going to be concrete or steel, but in this case, because of the slope of the site, it would be concrete. There'd be a concrete retaining wall at the back uphill side of the site. You're going to have a two-way aisle that comes in, and I think the minimum for that in most cases is 24 feet in width. And then you're going to have the turning radiuses and the parking stalls, the ability to get in and out of those stalls at 90 degrees, which is part of what requires the 24 foot width. And the stalls themselves are generally 18 feet to 20 feet deep, and you know, could be 8.5 to 9 feet, maybe a little bit wider in width. You know, in a parking structure underneath a residential building, you're going to have an elevator somewhere, possibly some stairs. If it's buried below grade or mostly below grade, you're likely to have a ventilation requirement that moves exhaust air or takes exhaust air out of the garage itself. If it's above grade, you can possibly get cross ventilation by having openings in the building, but you can't have dead ends. So you have to be able to ventilate the garage. Structurally, as I said, you're going to have a retaining wall, possibly shoring on the backside, which would in this case be on the uphill right-hand side of the image we're looking at. That wall is probably going to be, you know, about a foot thick.
Let me stop you real quick. For the structural stuff, do you work with structural engineers as part of your job?
Yeah, but what I'm explaining to you is based on my experience. I understand what kind of, you know, I've done a lot of these. I also have done a lot of construction administration on projects. Even when I was a principal, I would be involved in construction administration. So I've been in these projects quite a bit, and I understand the structural, mechanical, electrical, plumbing infrastructure that's required to construct a garage under a building, a residential building or any kind of building for that matter.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. I didn't mean to get you off of what you were talking about. Maybe we could go back and just explain what this image is now that we have it up on the screen, how what you've been testifying to sort of fits with what we're looking at.
Yeah, so the image is a little bit small on my screen, but anyway, it's a parking structure underneath a building. I believe it's shown underneath the current design for the garden apartments, but as an illustration, I'm showing that if you put a parking structure underneath the garden apartments, it would stick out on either side. In my experience, I wouldn't do it that way. I would align the exterior walls of the parking garage with the vertical walls of the residential building above for simplicity's sake, and for the ability to transition all of the structural elements of the residential above into the structural elements of the parking garage.
That topic, I think I'll try to pulling up Mr. Examiner and Parties Appellant Exhibit 8. Trying to pull up Appellant Exhibit 8. Can you see that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So have you reviewed this? I'll represent this as the Appellant's Exhibit 8, which is renderings of what we proposed on the left and then other proposals on the right.
Okay.
Have you reviewed this exhibit?
Yeah, I've looked at it.
So you were just talking about building straight up from the foundation rather than having a smaller building on top. And I was trying to get this exhibit so we could look at it while you're talking about that. So what are some problems with that design in your mind?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the structure of the building above. So you got a 45-foot width building, which I believe is that diagram is showing the original scheme width. So that must be the garden apartment width. So a couple of things. One is you've got a four-story building sitting on top of two-story parking garage. The parking garage, so you see the red line that's dashed that comes down into the garage where it says parking. Yeah, that one. So that's the vertical line projection of the building coming down. And when you have that, you're going to have four stories of seismic and vertical gravity loads that are coming down on that point. And in order to take this, and I'm not a structural engineer, but again, I've worked with enough of these that I understand what the issues are going to be. In order to take that seismic load out of that building and put it into the ground during an earthquake, you're going to be required to have a pretty extensive transfer beam that's going to sit underneath that structure, or a series of columns and transfer beams. Obviously, there'll be columns there too. So that's one issue. You've got an elevator pit for, because you're going to end up having an elevator. You're going to have a lobby. You could have internal ramps, but it's maybe possible to access the garage from the high grade and the low grade on either side. So you may not need an internal ramp. In my experience, the floor-to-floor heights are going to be, you know, he's showing 11 feet, so that's certainly adequate. You're going to have about 2 feet of structure supporting. So the top line of the parking garage underneath the building is going to be about 2 feet thick, because you have to have space for the post-tension slab that's going to be holding the building up above, or the floor of the building up above. You're going to have insulation per the energy code. You're going to have all of the plumbing piping that's coming out of the building above, going down through the garage and getting out of the building, and that has to slope to drain. You're going to have fire sprinklers, pipes, and mains and trunk lines. You're more than likely going to have, well, you are going to have a van parking stall in the garage that's going to require 98 inches or 8 feet 2 of clearance from the entry to the garage to the parking stalls themselves all the way through. And then you can drop it down to 7 feet. So, but you still have to have that 98 inches. So there's a lot of complexity to how the garage interacts with the building.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And it's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of information. Maybe I could break it down. That would help me a little bit. Talk about some of the things you said piece by piece. So when you talked about the red line that's coming down from what we're going to call the downslope area of the building, underneath the building, you said it's going to require extra structure. What is that? Why is that problem? I mean, what does that mean exactly? And why is that problematic?
Well, we're in an earthquake zone here that has, you know, a lot of earthquake intensity. We don't have a lot of earthquakes themselves, but when we do, we're likely to have a pretty serious earthquake. So what's going to happen is that building on top is going to be moving, you know, however it moves in the earthquake. The black wall on the left above that red dashed line is the exterior wall of the building, and almost every wall, the demising walls and the exterior walls, are going to be used as shear walls to take the seismic movement of the apartment house and transfer it down either into the ground, which would be the way it's done for the current design, or into the parking garage and then down into the ground if you have parking underneath it. So if, for instance, you took that red line and you shifted it to the left and aligned it with the where those people are standing, the exterior, the west wall of the parking garage, it would be much simpler to, you know, make that structural transition into grade.
So is it fair to say that, you know, you sort of have two, you have to design for two different structures, essentially?
Well, you're going to end up with a lot of redundant structure, and it's going to be very expensive, and it's going to be structural gymnastics, let's put it that way, in order to take the way this diagram is drawn, the gravity loads and the seismic loads from the movement of the building above down through that parking garage. You're just going to have a lot of complication to it.
And I think, do you say a lot of added costs? Is that was part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. You'd have added costs because now all of a sudden you've got maybe a 2-foot thick by 4-foot wide, you know, seismic transfer beam sitting in that garage right above where that first car is, where it says 20 cars, in order to move. And on the other side also, in order to remove that seismic load from the building.
Okay. Let's also just talk about the elevator while we're here. With this design here, with 45 foot width for the upper garden style apartment, could the elevator go all the way up with this sort of design?
Well, with the garden style, no, because you'd have to create lobbies on each floor of the apartment in order for the elevator to go up.
And so what does that mean? Maybe wider or?
I'm not sure I follow your question. Sorry.
Well, let me ask you this. I'll stop sharing for a second. So in the current garden style design, we just sort of looked at an image with the garden style design on top of a podium, one of the proposals right. By Mr. Adams. Is that accurate? Okay. Could you keep the garden style design that's been currently proposed and have elevators that run all the way to the top?
In my opinion, no.
Okay, and why not?
Because you would need to have elevator lobbies So you're going to get in the elevator and you're going to go up from the garage and into the building. And you're going to end up with an elevator lobby inside the building and a corridor down the center of the building, double loaded corridor. And you're going to end up with your apartments on the east and west side of that corridor, generally speaking. And then you'll have fire stairs at the ends or somewhere near the ends of the building. Two fire stairs.
So what's the difference between sort of that design with elevators and the current garden style?
Well, the current garden style, you know, is a simple building, and elevators are ubiquitous, but they're still one of the most complex pieces of a building. They're one of the most highly regulated aspects of a building. They punch a hole right through the center of the building, you know, a vertical shaft, which is, you know, always, from a code point of view, you know, not problematic, but it's, you know, you have to protect the rest of the building from that vertical shaft. Elevators create noise when they move, so you have to be thinking about how you insulate the walls around that elevator to keep elevator noise from the apartments that are adjacent to it and so on. You know, I've looked at a lot of the different similar projects built around Silverdale, and very few of them, well, most of them are all garden style apartments, and so they don't have elevators.
So would the building be the same size, or would it be larger, or?
Well, no, it would be larger. It would be wider.
Wider.
Probably about the same length, but wider. Well, yeah.
As far as costs, would they go up, stay the same?
If you are creating structured parking below the building, the costs are going to go up relative to the cost of that parking structure.
We'll talk about that more in depth. I just mean the elevators themselves. I mean,
oh yeah, well, elevators.
I know the stuff that you said would have to be added to a building for elevators.
Okay, so elevators, they're also problematic in terms of the, I think right now I actually talked to somebody about it. You know, ever since the pandemic, there have been a long lead time for elevators. So you have to actually order them way before construction starts. So, and they're expensive. They're an unnecessary expense for this type of apartment on this site.
So would the project be different in your, I mean, project would be different in your mind with elevators?
Yeah, I mean, it's different.
Let's go back to the structured parking. How many levels would there have to be to accommodate all the parking under the building? Under the buildings, I should say.
In my estimation, there'd probably be two, maybe two plus a half another. So possibly have to go a little bit lower, but two. I would say two.
At least two.
Yeah, at least two. You know, depending on how much parking is actually going to be required under the building, which I think is still a question. I don't know.
You want to go back to our exhibit B1. Bear with me, please. See that image?
I do.
Okay. And so are these the two levels that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you have an elevator below that. Why does the elevator have to be below the bottom level?
Elevators for commercial buildings have pits. The pit is generally 4 feet or more below the lowest service level, and it's there because There's equipment that is required there, and most likely in a building of this height, it's going to be a hydraulic elevator. So, you know, there's some hydraulic equipment that would be in the pit. And there's also, actually, it's not shown here, but there would also be a requirement by LNI to have what's called a sump. And the sump is another 18 inches deep from the top of the slab of the pit. So from the bottom of the pit, you go down another 18 inches and it's 18 or so inches square. And that's to capture any potential hydraulic fluid release, that might happen, and pump it out. The elevator pit would also require that it be well sealed against any kind of water intrusion.
Okay. And I think Mr. Adams in his report says you can get elevators, special elevators that are shallower. Do you have a response to that?
Yeah, so that surprised me. I looked into it, and I have not been able to find commercial elevators that don't have pits. I did see something about potential elevators without pits, but they were in Asia. I then decided to ask a person at Schindler Elevator Company in Seattle. She's the, I think, Northwest rep for Schindler. And she told me that their elevators for a 4 to 6 story building would require a pit of 4 feet or more in depth. I talked to one of my big general contractor principals that I've used in the past at GOI Construction in Bellevue, and they are not aware of commercial elevator with that is pitless, or to use another term, shallow. So, you know, my research indicates that there is not an option for, in a building like this, an elevator without a pit. Now, I do know that you can get an elevator for single family residential uses that are shallow or pitless.
But that's not this project.
That would not be this project. You're going to have an elevator that's probably at least 3,500 pound capacity. And that means that you've got a cab that's big enough to, you know, to get a stretcher into, basically. And also, you know, you want to have a big enough cab so that you can actually move furniture in and out of the building if you have an elevator, because that would be the process for getting furniture in and out.
Okay. And Mr. Examiner, I see it's almost 10:30. I probably have about 15, maybe 20 minutes left on this witness. I don't know if you want
okay.
to take yeah, a I'll break.
Sure, I'll take our break till 10:45. We'll see you then.
Okay, thank you.